The sun has left and forgotten me. It's dark, I cannot see.
Your stories don't define you, but how you tell them will. Hi, I'm Sarah Elkins, your host and chief story maker at Elkins Consulting. Whether you're sharing a business story or a personal story, what matters is how the person in front of you is receiving that story. Why are you sharing it? What do you want that person to know about you? That's what this episode and all of the episodes of this podcast are about. So today we get to welcome Blake Hutchison, and he's calling all the way from Melbourne, Australia, which was lovely to hear because I went to school. I studied abroad in Australia many, many years ago. And I always love catching up with people from that side of the planet. So Blake, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Sarah. And yeah, that was a pleasant surprise to hear that you'd studied all the way over here in Australia. So great to connect. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, the funny thing is why I chose Australia of all the places I could have gone in the world. It's because I had just seen that movie, The Legend of Greystoke Tarzan, and part of it was filmed there on the east coast of Australia. And I was so enamored with the waterfalls and the rainforest that that's where I decided to go.
Isn't it funny why we choose certain places, particularly when we're maybe a little bit younger? My first ever trip abroad was I moved to Japan, and I moved there with like $500 in my back pocket. And I had a job teaching English. I was 20 years old, and I went there just because I liked Japanese culture. But the funniest thing about that statement was I didn't really know what Japanese culture was. I thought I knew, and clearly it was different to what I knew when I got there. So it is funny why you choose certain locations, but that experience actually in Japan almost framed my thinking for, you know, I'd say for the rest of my life, because I was probably a little bit insular until I got there. And so you change as a person when you go and travel and experience those things, don't you?
Absolutely. This is not the first time this has come up in a conversation on this podcast. I'm such a huge believer in leaving where you grew up, at least for a few years, so that you can figure out what your identity is outside of the environment and the people that you grew up with, because otherwise you will remain in that identity without exploring it. And I think that's such a sad waste of experience.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
So I was going to start by asking you to share something about yourself that most people don't know about you, but I'm guessing a lot of people don't know that you went to work in Japan.
So I'm based in Melbourne, Australia now, and I am a Melburnian, but I subscribe to everything you've just articulated. So I moved to Japan when I was 20, and I lived there for a year. No intention to ever become a teacher, but the easiest job you could get, and when you're 20, you try to find easy things to do. The easiest job I could get was one teaching English 20 hours a week. So I taught English to a combination of people, either execs at companies like Toyota and Honda and Mitsubishi and Sony, or two-year-olds. And so like the...
Which sometimes are very similar.
Lesson was like an hour, I think it was 45 minutes long actually. And so you'd go from having sort of conversational English with an exec who clearly knew how to speak the language but wanted that conversational capability, all the way through to whacking a poster of a green frog and yelling out green frog as you tried to teach a two-year-old their first words in English. It was quite a dynamic experience now that I think back on it. And then I moved to San Francisco for 6 years. So I've certainly had my fair share of living and experiencing different places, and boy, oh boy, it's the right way to do it.
Totally agree. I think every person should have to study somewhere else for a minimum of 6 months outside of their country, preferably where they don't speak the language, which I didn't do. But I have to say, when I got into the outback for a little while for a couple of day trips, it sounded like a different language. So yeah. Didn't always understand what was being said. But I also, I'm a big believer in people trying working in a restaurant for a year and in retail for a year. So they really get a feel for what working with the public is like. I think you develop so much more empathy and compassion for the people around you when you do that.
Yeah, I think so hospitality and retail are two of the most underrated professions when it relates to being able to apply a customer-centric viewpoint later on in your career, should you say choose a career in like consulting or an agency environment, or here like in a flipper type environment where it's a tech business building product for a customer type, you develop an empathy for customers because you're so close to them through the retail and hospitality contexts. And certainly I was working in a sports shop selling people running shoes. And so, you know, people would come in and they'd want a pair of shoes because they looked a certain way, but their feet operated a different way. So you'd have to recommend a different type of shoe, even if they didn't like the look of it. And you learn so much about people and so much about presenting them what they want, but also what is right for them through that experience, that I think you can genuinely apply that experience later on in life too.
Pretty much everything you can apply that to. I think even to having children, you can apply. And the same goes for having children. You can apply what you learned from that experience into everything else in your life. And definitely compassion plays a role in that. So this leads me perfectly into kind of where I wanted to go with this. When you have had experiences where you were hiring people, mm-hmm. is there somebody in your head that you knew had that kind of experience, that retail or hospitality experience, that maybe didn't have the qualifications on paper that the position really was looking for, but you just knew because they had this other experience that they would be able to do the job and do it well?
Yeah, I'll give you a couple of examples. One, I can think of countless people who have hired into sales roles where they have either worked or not worked based on their prior experience. And so let's, for argument's sake, look at a very high-functioning, high-achieving student out of college or university, as we call it here in Australia. They'll come and present the best marks. They'll come and present the subjects, courses, etc., that they have completed. And then let's compare that same person to someone who has maybe not excelled at the same levels, but has experience in hospitality or retail, and then put them on the phone as an SDR. That's what we call a sales development representative, or a BDR. So SDR tends to be inbound, or a BDR, which is business development representative, that tends to be outbound, and test them against that same person who has applied for the job with those excellent university credentials and acumen. And I will almost put my house on the fact that the person in retail or hospitality can outpace them. I actually have lots of those examples. To take it a slightly different way, I have a really nice story of someone who I knew had the work ethic, but also the skill set to be really special in our workforce. So our chairman was filling up his car at a local 7-Eleven. Now, here in Australia, it might sound weird to you over there in Montana, but here in Australia, 7-Elevens are also gas stations or service stations. I'm not sure if that's the same over there. But anyway, it's where you fill up your car. Mm-hmm. And so he'd met this individual multiple times, and this individual was completing a master's of business analytics or data science. And this person was not from Australia. He was from India, and he couldn't find any employer to give him a shot. So he'd been working in the service station. And every time our chairman drove into that service station, this individual would start a conversation. And then this individual ultimately said, "Andrew, can I ask you what you do for a living? I've now met you multiple times. You've come to the gas station. And if you wouldn't mind, can I tell you what my skill set is? Because it's not filling up cars." And so Andrew met this person and rang me and said, "Blake, I know the exact type of person you like to work with. You like to work with the person who has the theoretical capability matched with the hustler mentality. And I said, yes, please. And he said, well, I've got just that person. And this person has now worked in our org for 3 years. This person is arguably one of our single most dependent people. In other words, we are all dependent on him to do the work he does as a business analyst and data scientist. Never lets us down. Hustles whenever required. We can throw any report, any data science, any ask at him. Always going above and beyond. We've worked with other people with the exact same qualification who don't come from the as humble as hustler background or beginnings, who just don't give us what we want at the speed or at the level of with the level of passion and enthusiasm. And that to me is a function of where he's come from to be able to achieve what he's now achieved.
Mm-hmm. That story is so important for people to hear. I remember when I was in restaurant industry, I spent over 10 years waiting tables, cocktailing, bartending, whatever. And I remember one of the other servers at one of the restaurants where I was working was just kind of putting in the time. You know, she just didn't care that much. It was just a job to her. And she said, I don't understand why you put so much into this, why you're always so nice to everybody. And you're always just, you know, moving, doing stuff. And I mm-hmm. said, I never know who's going to be in here and what opportunities I might be making for myself by showing up the way that I do.
Yep. Yep.
And she didn't get it. I was so surprised by that.
So care and customer empathy will go a lot further than IQ, in my opinion. And so we can call
absolutely.
That. And so, you know, we had an example where someone was selling an asset on Flipper for $500,000, so $500,000. And someone in our sales, post-sales team, which basically handles the escrow and the trust account so that the money is transferred securely, it's recognized, eyeballed, and then is transferred out securely to the person who is meant to be the recipient of it, said, I'm too busy. I refuse to call this customer. And I was like, so just to be clear, you're too busy to help someone out who is about to have their first and likely only ever exit event. You're unwilling to spend an extra 5 minutes of your day welcoming that person to the Flipper escrow experience because of how busy your day has been. And after I explained it to him that way, he ultimately went and did it, right? But there is, it was a function of, I'll first think about how much time I've put in versus thinking about what that customer needs from me right now. And that little bit of extra care and empathy ends up giving you a bit more willingness and want to help a customer too. And so that can be missing sometimes, but when it's there, it's really powerful.
So is this, I have to ask this, and I don't, hopefully this person listens or doesn't listen to this, depending on how this comes out. My first thought was that that would change your perception of the person in terms of how they are as a worker, as a human. My next thought is, was this common behavior for that person to dismiss the call for this client who clearly needs that support? And then the third part is, did something change when they realized what you were putting in front of them?
Yeah. So I'd say it was a common pat. And yes, it did change my perception, and my perception has been altered forever. And I think the difference is related to whether you put yourself in somebody else's shoes or you only ever walk in your own.
Mm-hmm.
Walking in your own creates for a very narrow-minded approach to doing work or living. fulfilled life. And walking in other people's shoes gives you agility and flexibility and gives you understanding and ultimately gives you empathy. And so part of it is, do you work for yourself? Do you work for the team? Do you work for the company, or do you work for the customer? And so I tell my staff that they work for the customer. And suppose, so a lot of people will say, well, you know, my boss told me to do this. I said, I don't actually care what your boss told you to do. What I'm most interested in is, what does the customer need? Because if you help out the customer, it will tend to help out the company. And if you can help out the company, your team will then be better performing. And so if your team is better performing, then you're more fulfilled. And if you're more fulfilled, then you get paid more. And if you get paid more, then you can do whatever you want. And so when we take a top of funnel view of the world versus a bottom funnel view of the world,
right,
selves, and you should start from somebody else.
That I never thought about it quite from that perspective, but it makes so much sense. I always wondered why companies would leave the lowest common denominator person as the receptionist, like sitting at the front desk. The first interaction a person has with your company is this person that is getting paid the least of all the people in your company. Why in the world would you do that? I just never understood that. And what I'm hearing you say is that's how you think about things, is who is going to be interacting with my customers, because I want my customers to have the best interaction, especially their first interaction with my company, has to be with somebody who cares about them.
Yeah. Yeah. So you get certain things like our average response time is X. It's like, you know, I get the data, I get the average, but why did that customer have a 6-hour response time? So I get the data, I can see the graphs. I'm actually not interested in the graphs. What I'm interested in understanding is how this particular customer had an experience which was subpar. And so if you orientate to every individual customer needs, it tends to be that the graphs will take care of themselves and continue to look the way you want them to look, and even better in most cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell me about an experience with your company. So far, our listeners don't actually know what you do, which is fine, because I love giving our listeners some context about why you do what you do before they actually hear what your income producing activity is. So without telling us what you do, can you tell us, you kind of alluded to it when you said that you had somebody, a customer who was selling a $500,000 asset, or I think is what you called it. And I would love for you to share a story like that, or that story about what exactly was it that your company provided for this customer in story form.
So we represent small business owners. Specifically, they are small business owners who operate in the digital economy. And so that could be someone who owns a e-commerce store, and that e-commerce store is powered by Shopify. It could be someone who writes a blog, and that blog is powered by WordPress. It could be someone who writes a newsletter about their favorite recipes or food or exercise regimes or marketing tactics or whatever that newsletter happens to be about, and that's powered by Substack. And so then we're a marketplace. So those business owners can exit or sell those businesses to a network of buyers and investors. Think of it as eBay for buying businesses. They just happen to be digital in nature. So we have lots of stories in this regard. So let's just go through a few because they're super fun. For instance, there is a blogger in Chicago, and she had a crochet blog that she'd been running for 20 years.
And wow.
She was retiring. And so this blog was all about crochet, and she would obviously contribute some content, but the vast majority of the content was contributed by a crochet community. So people who were equally as passionate as her about crochet. And so obviously as she moved to retirement age, or maybe even beyond that, she started to think about, okay, well, for 20 years I've operated this blog, presumably it's worth something. And in fact, most of the time it is. And so she was able to list that, connect with a buyer, and ultimately sell that blog for $90,000 in 48 hours on our platform. She was subsequently in tears because she'd never seen money of that quantum before. And then her retirement is now feeling a little more accessible and exciting potentially as well. And so
90 as a 90.
90, yes, 90.
90,000. Okay. 90, yeah. 000. I just want to make sure our listeners heard that. She sold this blog business for $90,000. And my guess is that the business itself had assets in terms of advertisers and contributors. And so it was worth money for that purpose.
Yeah, that's a good question. So typically something is worth something to someone else when it's perceived by that someone else as an investment. And so what the person was buying was the revenue base, of course, the traffic base, of course, the community, but that's the input. And then the output is the revenue. And clearly you then minus the costs and you come up with some kind of net profit or EBITDA or some kind of adjusted profit statement or number. And you then sell on a multiple of that. So let's say for argument's sake, she was making $30,000 net profit. Maybe it was purchased for 3x net profit multiple. There's the $90,000. And that's how that's derived. So if you're out there and you've got a podcast or you've got a newsletter or you've got a blog or you've got an e-commerce business, the key point actually is that your blood, sweat, and tears, your passion is actually worth something to someone else. So when that time arises in the future that you might want to move on, our marketplace can support you in that regard. So that's kind of, I'll give you another example that's substantially different to that. So there was a gentleman by the name of John Chen. He's actually in New York City. And he was an intern at a hedge fund. He then decided he didn't want to be, in finance. And so he ultimately sought out businesses that he could buy and use some of the tricks and trades he had learned as part of his internship or his early stage career in that particular industry. He ended up buying a jewelry website called Blush and Bar. blushandbar.com. He bought that on Flipper for $7,500. He then exited that on Flipper 2.5 years later for $550,000. And so ultimately what he's been able to do is ply his trade on a product or platform, which he may or may not been particularly that passionate about, but what he was passionate about was business ops. And so he was able to get operational effectiveness out of this asset. And as a function of that, he was able to grow the asset. As a function of that, he was then able to exit the asset. And he now professionally buys businesses, optimizes those. He essentially does operate like private equity, but it's a single-man show. And, you know, he loves us as a function of that. In fact, one of the most beautiful experiences we've ever had here at Flipper was he sent me a note. He said, Blake, I happen to be in Austin, Texas. Can I go and visit your team there? I said, well, of course you can, John. So he walked in, he pulled out of his pocket a handwritten letter, and he read to our sales team in Austin, Texas, this story of how Flipper had changed his life and how he was now doing the thing he'd always wanted to do with the help of our platform. And so, you know, you've got the passionate crochet individual on one end, and then you've got the business maker ops expert on the other end. Regardless, they're having good experiences on the platform, achieving what they've set out to achieve. And so this kind of happens in multiple areas. Someone's passionate about a business model, so they'll buy something. Someone's passionate about a particular topic. There was a blog, like a content site called Theater Nerds. And it was about Broadway and off-Broadway. And the gentleman who owned it, he was going on to do his MBA at Columbia, lucky gent, and he then decided to list that asset on Flipper for sale. I must admit, I can't remember the price, but it was, you know, between $100,000 and $200,000 or something like that. And he wasn't responding to the buyers. And I happen to be in New York, and I'm based in Melbourne. And I was like, I'm actually just going to call this guy and introduce myself. And what I'm going to say to him is, you've chosen to use our platform and there's a lot of interested people and you're actually choosing not to respond to them. And I'd just like to know why. So I called him up and I said, Blake Hutchison here, CEO of Flipper. Hope you're doing well. I noticed you've got an asset listed on our platform and you've got, you know, whatever, 25 interested parties here and you haven't responded. And he said, oh, look, Blake, I'm just so busy preparing for my M&A. And I said, well, look, it may be a lot easier to get through your MBA if you get an exit between $100,000 and $200,000 in the next sort of 30 days. And he said, yeah, good point. And I said, just spend the next, you know, day responding to all of the interested parties there and let's see what comes of it. If nothing comes of it in the next couple of weeks, you know, let's remove the listing so that we don't bother the buyers and they think they're inquiring on something that isn't actually for sale. Anyway, he sold to an actor. And so the actor was super passionate, obviously, about acting. The actor was super passionate about Broadway and off-Broadway. And the actor was like, I love this. I can buy this asset. And while I'm looking for acting gigs, while I'm trying to find my mark as an actor, I've actually got something in an industry that I'm passionate about and know a lot about. And so he found his pathway to Flipper as a function of wanting to go and do an MBA. And the buyer found their pathway to a new business that they now own as a function of being passionate about acting. And so we love those stories, of course.
Of course you do. That's great. I love hearing the differences in why people get into looking at this as an opportunity, because it's not something I would ever have thought about. And I remember when I received the request to be on the podcast, I was thinking, what even is this? And I looked at the website and I still didn't understand what it was. And I always thought of myself as, you know, kind of clever, but I'm looking at this going, okay, I'm not sure what this is about. And those explanations make so much sense to me. So thank you for sharing those stories.
Yeah. So imagine it is. So there's a lot of people in the world who trade stocks. Mm-hmm. And so just as a matter, imagine it as a trading platform for small businesses. You're not trading a big stock, a portion of a big company. You're trading a large portion of a small company.
Right. That makes so much sense. So I just interviewed my brother on this podcast.
That's
the first
great.
Time, 300 and something episodes, I finally interviewed him. And one of the things I asked him was, where do you see your role in the company over the next 5 years? Because he owns a social media strategy company in Denver, and he has, I don't know, a dozen employees or something like that. And he said he doesn't really have direct contact with clients so much anymore because his staff is amazing. They do fantastic. He's trained them and they do what he would have done. And he has a structure and manages learning and growing because social media is always changing. And he said that his goal is to make sure that his staff own what they're doing, love what they're doing, and grow into the next roles that they want in the organization. So my guess is that because you are the CEO of the company, that you are in a similar position where you're not necessarily doing direct contact with clients. So when you think about nurturing the people around you, what is one experience you had recently that you walked away from feeling really satisfied? Like this was, you were meant to do what you're doing right now.
Yeah. I'll give you unfortunately, a long answer. So the first part of the answer is...
This is all about stories. It's all good.
I still do have contact, and there's a few reasons for that. So we're you know, what you might call a venture capital-backed scaler. And so we're always trying to change the way our business operates to get more out of the company, grow faster, and appeal to a bigger base of customers. And so I'm always managing one account at any given time. And that keeps me close to the tools. And so behind the scenes of any given account is what we call the deal room. And in the deal room, you've got your buyers, you've got the due diligence materials, you've got some AI playing out where it matches up programmatically and those types of things. And being a party to that as the CEO enables me to be a participant when the advisors or customer success team are assisting our customers, or when the product team needs a feedback loop. I can be party to those conversations, which personally I like, as well as I think I still need to do. And then there is the piece where you're able to be good at capital allocation and then stand back from that and see how that's actually played out and worked for you. So I would say the best example of that right now is we chose to expand our organization into Europe. And so that has been one of the cases where it's been very hands-off. It's been a function of saying, well, here I clearly am in Melbourne. I clearly don't understand the European market to the levels and capability of anyone who we've recruited and now based there. And we need to give them the capital. We need to give them the confidence, and we need to give them some feedback around strategy, but essentially it's their market to grow. Now, that's now our fastest growing market, and it's now our second biggest revenue generating market. And that's a function of simply moving from an organically organized, organically managed part of our marketplace to a marketplace that is now got five dedicated people running the European function. They know buyers in that universe. They've been pitching to sellers in that universe. They are a feedback loop to the product team in that universe. They're hosting meetups in that universe. They're doing all of this stuff. And so it's been a very proud moment to say, well, we can tackle market expansion. We can go hands off. We can recruit talent in those areas and say, you own Flipper in those areas. And we can see our company thrive and grow as a function of that. And that's been really satisfying.
I'm sure. Are there particular people that pop into your head when you think about that? People that, okay, I would love to hear that.
Yeah, so I think that first and foremost, you need to get someone who, you trust on the ground, who's going to represent the organization the way that you have set out for that organization to be represented. And then you need to give them the leg rope to obviously represent the organization the way that that continent or that geography needs to be represented. And so we recruited a gentleman by the name of Ben Gould, and he's our commercial director based in Amsterdam. And he's been responsible for everything from recruiting the next set of talent, so advisors, SDRs, customer support in that region, as well as representing the organization, be it speaking at events, being on podcasts, or being part of, like a customer advisory council. And so he's been able to drive a way of working in Europe, which is slightly substantially similar, but nuanced to the way we work elsewhere. I mean, he's done a very good job of that. And we need to give credit where credit's due. And then we need to continue to give that, expand that remit of the responsibility so his influence can grow within the org.
So how did you learn that? Because this is not something that just happens as a manager and leader, that you have the, first of all, the clarity of who to hire and what they need to be, but also that ability to nurture somebody, knowing that they don't necessarily have everything that you need from them when they first start, and the patience that it takes. What was your experience? Either many of us learn the critical lessons from the worst managers we've experienced, but sometimes we learn from the best managers. So where did that come from? Because it didn't just show up for you.
I think there's a couple of things. So I've learned over time to be less focused on people's weaknesses and more focused on people's strengths. And so can we isolate what people are really good at and then direct them to use those skills? And can we isolate what they're less good at? And whilst acknowledging them and hopefully over time improving those weaknesses in such a way that they might become strengths, be less focused on them, frankly, because in time-poor environments like venture-backed scale-ups, you're actually better off not getting someone to do something that they don't know how to do or they don't want to do. You're better off getting to do the things that they want to do and they're really good at. And so part of it is saying, well, who did we get and what are they actually good at? And then saying, okay, well, we'll let you do that bit of it. Mm-hmm. And that's a muscle that we've got to flex. I've got to flex that a lot better as well. Because you can say, well, all right, well, you're in charge of Europe, so can you go and do this? Because that's implied as part of the
job. Where did you learn it, though? I mean, it's not something that just came to you, right?
It's mistake making. So you have to, like, people will say, but Blake, what if this is a mistake? I'm like, how great would that be? Won't that be awesome if we stuff this? And they're like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, we're picking these things we're going to do. We clearly can't do them all. So let's find the first one that we're really bad at and then drop that. And then find the first one that we're really good at and intensively go after that one. And so part of it is being hungry for change so that you can discover fast enough. And so I say to people when they're interviewing at Flippit, do you like change? Just generally in your life. Like, do you like change? And some people don't like change. How many times have you moved house? Never. How many times have you gone abroad? Very few. How many times did you change school when you were a kid? Because actually you weren't in control of that change, but it can sometimes build a resilience and adaptability in an individual if they've gone through those experiences at a young age. So if we find out that someone hasn't experienced change a great deal in their life, they're highly unlikely to be a good fit for our organization. That's doing them a favor, and it's doing us a favor too, right? Because we're change heavy. And so we have to get people in the organization who are change heavy. And if we can figure that out, it tends to mean that we can flex our muscles a bit quicker.
So what was the story of a bad manager that you had that you learned a lesson from like this? Because I think a lot about that. I worked in a place where this person was just mean. She would say cruel things. It was one of those lessons that I thought, I will never be that boss. And I can tell you that a few years later, when I was managing somebody, I noticed something similar come out of my mouth. And I immediately apologized and said, oh no, I didn't like it when that happened to me. I'm never going to do that. So what was your experience like that?
I've certainly got some stories I could tell of where managers have just been blatantly rude, but I'm not sure we're going to get a lot out of that. I think it's kind of three types of people. There's people who create, people who do, and people who do nothing. And so kind of not really interested in the do nothing people because they're not going to help our organization or our customers. And then there's the create and do. So you've got to figure out whether they're a create or whether they're a do. Someone who creates comes up with a great idea. And as a function of coming up with that great idea, they let the organization move into a new space or test a new opportunity. And then there's someone who actually does. They're the person who takes that idea, takes that existing project or initiative, and executes against the requirements. And you need both of those. But it's actually harder to find creators than it is doers. And then there are people who, they're kind of the three types of people. But then within that, what we say here at Flippit is think, say, plan, do. So some people who are really big thinkers, they kind of don't tell you what they're thinking. So how do you encourage quiet, smart, big thinkers to come out of their shell? And bad managers won't do that because they don't want to listen to the most junior person in the room. So shut up for a moment and ask the most quiet people in the room what their biggest ideas, passions, ambitions, or problems are, and you'll learn a lot about where you're going wrong as a manager or where your organization can improve. So good manager will shut up. They'll listen to the most junior person in the room. Bad manager won't. And then you get this concept of a person who is a good fit for one organization, but not a good fit for another organization. So you can have a manager who sits on the ivory tower and can think big and can bark orders. But actually, in an organization that is at a certain stage of its growth cycle, they actually need the person who is the most senior equally contributing. And so depending on what your culture has, a bad manager can let down their staff because they don't fit the cultural makeup of the existing cultural makeup or DNA. And so we've found that some bad managers might have been good elsewhere, but then they walk into Flipper and they're really good at strategy. And then their staff are waiting for them to actually contribute and do something, and they don't. And then the staff will say, like, they're not actually selling alongside me. And so they thought that was okay because they'd come from a very big org where you had lots of resource and lots of capital around you, and you just actually dictated what other people should do. But in our organization, we expect that everyone's helping out. Mm-hmm. And that's just our culture. And so often bad managers are only bad because they don't fit the culture. So I've certainly had, for instance, we've hired from big logos from time to time. I had a very, very senior growth marketer, ex-Netflix, ex-YouTube, ex-Facebook, ex-Google, big titles, big money, couldn't do anything. Unbelievable, like shocked us all. Some of the most basic things.
I've had experiences like that.
it was like we were actually gobsmacked. Couldn't do the most basic growth marketing things that we would just take for granted, despite their head of growth marketing title, despite their history of working in these orgs, because they'd had no requirement to ever get on the tools and actually do anything.
So did you have a boss that really encouraged you and nurtured you? I mean, who was your support that helped you see what a good boss does? You're explaining what a good boss does. I totally understand that. I've had more bad than good. But that said, who was one of your mentors?
So I think, you know, our current chairman has a very good head on his shoulders. He's got a very mature, balanced approach to things. And I think I would consider him not only a chairman and obviously a director of the company, but a mentor. And then I've had other people. I'd say my first boss out of university, a guy by the name of Jeff Trounce, was an outstanding manager, an outstanding leader, and I would have considered a mentor, albeit, you know, we don't catch up that often anymore. What I think is actually more important than having a designated mentor is diversity of experience. And so people often say, Blake, how did you become the CEO of Flipper? I don't get it. Like, I look at your LinkedIn resume, whatever you want to call it, and you worked for a SaaS company in the accounting software space. So that was zero.
Software as a service for our listeners.
You worked for an e-commerce company that was selling luxury travel. You worked for the largest travel guidebook publisher in the world. That's publishing, Lonely Planet. You started your own marketplace for specialty food providers. How? I don't get it. And you know what's amazing about that is you get diversity of bosses, diversity of managers, diversity of people, diversity of business models, diversity of categories. You become quite well-rounded because you just pick and choose the best of all of them.
For sure.
For any given circumstance or situation. Whereas some people apply for a job and you've got, well, all I've done is work in this for this period of time and I've been promoted every step of the way. But then when they step into a new environment, they don't have the diversity of experience to provide the best viewpoint.
Absolutely. I keep coming back to your chairman and his finding this young man at the 7-Eleven service station.
Yeah, it's the best.
It is the best. And the reason I come back to that is that a lot of times in my keynote presentations, I will say, the stories that you tell about other people say a lot about who you are and what you value. And one of the stories that I like to share is very similar to that, where someone was telling a story as a keynote. I got to do a breakout session right after this, so it was a really easy turnaround. And it was young adults for the AmeriCorps and Vista here in Montana. And the keynote had told a story about a governor that he had interacted with that I had never heard of. And probably most of the young people in the audience of 300 or 400 young people hadn't heard of this person. But by the end of the keynote, everyone had this person's character in their heads about what a generous and thoughtful and kind person this was. So as I was talking to this group and doing this exercise in the breakout session about storytelling, I said, okay, I want to hear words to describe this man that the keynote, and I said his name, was talking about. Remember, he told this story about this governor. what are some of the words you'd use to describe him? And they were saying things like generous and inspirational and motivated and ambitious, like all these wonderful, huge value words. And I said, wow, that's amazing, because what you're saying here is you're describing this man you've never met before. All yeah. in these huge, important words, all based on a story that was told to you 30 minutes ago by someone you've never met before.
Yeah.
So this total stranger tells a story about another total stranger, and suddenly you have this stranger in your head as being magnificent, really. And as you told the story of your chairman, I'm thinking, oh, I like this man. Oh my gosh. I would be friends with him. I want to meet this guy. So I would love to hear another story like that. Like the way that you talk about other people says a lot about who you are, and the way you told that story was really meaningful to me. Do you have more stories like that that we could wrap this in before we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, the first name and person that comes to mind when you ask that question is actually my wife. So, you know, I hope that's appropriate, but, you know, at the
absolutely.
End of the day, she's a Mexican-American woman who has achieved a lot in her life, having come from very little. And she's taught me a lot about race. She's taught me a lot about gender. She's taught me a lot about taking opportunities by the scruff of the neck. She's taught me a lot about respecting people of all backgrounds, all classes, all everything. And so part of that is she's just got a warm, welcoming demeanor to her. So if you can open yourself up to people, you tend to benefit. And so when the phone call comes from the chairman that says, I've met this guy down the street at the local gas station, are you willing to speak to him? I know lots of people who would not have received that phone call in the first place, because people would perceive them to be closed down to that idea. It's too right. hard.
Right.
And so I guess I'll combine the two of them, and I would describe that as being nice, being humble, and being smart. And so if you're nice, people will gravitate to you. If you're humble, you'll tend to take on more knowledge. And if you're smart, you'll tend to apply all of what you've just learned to new circumstances. And so
that
tends
to. Absolutely. I love that. That's perfect. That's exactly what I was looking for. How did you meet your wife? Was it when you were living in San Francisco?
Oh, Sarah, that's just like the most non-romantic circumstance. It's a bar in San Francisco called Left of Albuquerque.
I've heard of that bar.
It's a Saturday. I'm sitting at the bar and we said hello. It's actually just not a romantic story, but she's a beautiful human.
I would say that's pretty romantic. To meet at a bar, unexpected. It's not like either of you went in there anticipating that you would walk out with your future spouse.
No, that's true.
So that can be a romantic story. We'll just have to find the way to frame it. That'll be a good challenge later on when we talk again. Okay, well, let's come full circle. You studied in Japan. You clearly understand how travel and experiencing a lot of different things can make you not only a more compassionate human, but also better at whatever you choose to do. So yes. When you think back on your time in Japan, I know when I think about Australia, there's an image that pops into my head immediately of,
yep.
This is kind of funny, it's a picture of me holding a koala at one of those places where you can do that. And the reason yep. that picture comes to my head is because my grandmother, I sent it to my grandmother and she had it in there until the day she died, it was in her place. So that's, for some reason, that's the image that pops into my head. What's your image of Japan?
Wow, it's a great question. I'd actually say the image of Japan that I have is people. So as we all know, it's one of the most populous, well, Tokyo, one of the most populous cities in the world. And so I can't escape that image of walking to work each night across the Shinjuku or Shibuya, one of them, crosswalks that is famous, on my way to the office, just being completely overwhelmed, but also excited by just how many people were around me. I love it.
Oh, that's so great. I love that. And I now have that image in my head. There's a show called Midnight Cafe that takes place in Tokyo. Have you seen that?
Not.
Oh, highly recommend it. And that crosswalk is in that movie. That's that famous place that they show in movies and TV shows all the time. So that's perfect. Blake, thank you so much for this conversation. It's been really an interesting conversation. I know that our listeners will be very curious to check out the website. Is there anything you would want our listeners to know before we wrap this up?
No, Sarah, thank you so much. It's been great to tell the stories. But obviously, for the entrepreneurs and business owners around the world, you know, please do check out Flipper. We'd obviously love you to do that. But thank you so much.
My pleasure. So listeners, the links to Flippa and to connect with Blake will be on the show notes associated with this podcast at elkinsconsulting.com. Listeners, now it's your turn. What did you take from this conversation? Was it something about wanting to travel? Do you have the travel bug again? Was it something about a new business or an idea you have that maybe you need to take that next step? Because thinking about it isn't going to start it. And who are you going to surround yourself with? Because if you're a thinker and not necessarily a doer, you need some doers in your circle. I would love to hear your thoughts in the comments. Please don't hesitate to reach out. Thanks for listening.
Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile. If you just smile.